I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A two-day summit is underway in Brussels, where European Union leaders are expected to propose opening talks with Turkey about future membership. If issues of human rights violations, Turkey's huge labor force, and its recognition of Cyprus can be resolved, Turkey will become the first Muslim country to join the EU. Joining us on the line from London here now is Michael Goldfarb. And Michael, Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan says on the other side of the ledger, he wants a guarantee that the talks won't go on for a dozen years, as many have suggested they will. Why might this process take so long?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First, in the process, there's a certain amount of harmonizing of economic and business practice that has to go on between any country applying to join and the members of the union. And there are concerns that, you know, that Turkish business practices aren't as transparent as they should be. And also, when you join, you pay dues to be a member of the European Union, but then based on the conditions in your country, you can expect to get money back from the European Union. So there's a lot of economic adjustment that needs to happen on the Turkish side before it can be fully accepted as a member in the EU.
Not just fear that many of these workers would flood into Europe, but that these are Muslims and, you know, countries are saying outright, we want to maintain a Christian EU.
Some leaders have made that statement, but last night, for example, Jacques Chirac, French president, went on television to give an interview and explain why he thought it was a good idea that Turkey should be ultimately accepted into the EU. Currently, French public opinion polls show about 70% of people think it's a bad idea.
Well, what is the sentiment in Great Britain?
Well, the sentiment in Great Britain is this is not a big question at the moment, because today everybody's dealing with the political earthquake of the resignation of David Blunkett, British Home Secretary, and Tony Blair's key ally in the cabinet. This is a story of lust, love, loneliness at the top, politics plus class plus transatlantic relations. David Blunkett, blind since birth, rose by the dint of the most astonishing will to become the third most powerful man in Britain. He is a longtime divorcee and some 3 years ago became involved with an American woman named Kimberly Fortier Quinn. A child was born, and it's unfortunately, Kimberly Fortier Quinn is actually married to somebody else. So as the whole relationship unraveled, Blunkett had fast-tracked a British visa application for Kimberly Fortier Quinn's nanny from the Philippines. You know, the nannies will always get them in the end in politics. Mm-hmm. And he denied it, and then an internal investigation revealed he had at least discussed it with officials in the Immigration and Nationalization Service here, which fall under the Home Office control.
This is just a huge story. How is it affecting Tony Blair?
Blunkett actually spoke the language of the people. He had the license not to speak with political circumspection. On top of that, because he is blind and has been blind since birth, I don't think he quite understands what a poker face is. So if he's angry about something, you know, you see the anger in his face. Mm-hmm. He seemed a real person at the heart of government. And as Blair tries to get to grips with a strong law and order agenda, it was Blunkett who was able to go out and say, look, I grew up on a housing estate, which is the same as a housing project. I know how crime and drug use blights people's lives. We have to make our working classes feel secure and comfortable in their homes. So don't worry about the sociology of this stuff. We can be tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime. And he was an excellent spokesman for, you know, this upper middle class man who's essentially leading, you know, the Labour Party, which grew out of the working man's movement.
This all was revealed because he was pursuing some sort of custody of this child that he bore with his mistress, and made some incredibly emotional statements about that.
Yeah, it is astonishing. I mean, usually, particularly in British politics, if somebody gets caught having an affair, he tries to deny all responsibility for any children that may have come out of the affair. Blunkett is just the opposite. He wants to be in touch with his son, who is now 2 years old. He was the most extraordinarily touching interviews last night. I mean, rarely have I seen any politician so open about their love life. He said, I misunderstood what we had, speaking of his relationship, that someone could do this, not just to me, but to a little one as well. Well, you know, how many senior political figures would confess to such brokenheartedness? short of Margaret Thatcher being forced out of office, this is, you know, the biggest political earthquake I've reported on.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Spain's dual wars on terrorism intersect this week with a recent spate of bombings from an old threat and a massive investigation into a new one. Spain is holding parliamentary hearings into the March 11th Madrid train bombings that killed 191. Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility, but politicians were accused of manipulating the event, blaming it initially and wrongly on ETA, the Basque separatist group that's waged a 50-year campaign of bombings and killings and has recently reemerged. Joining us on the phone from Madrid is Keith Johnson of the Wall Street Journal. Hello, Keith.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. And let's start first with these hearings that are happening to investigate the Madrid train bombings. This is Spain's version of the September 11th Commission, a panel that was formed in July. It's interviewed more than 50 former police and government officials. This week, current Prime Minister José Luis Rodrigo Zapatero testified. He was elected right after the bombings. What did he have to say?
Basically, his testimony was there to reinforce the line that his Socialist Party had been saying since the attacks and the elections back in March. And that was, in a nutshell, that the previous administration, the center-right government of José María Aznar, had committed a massive cover-up or a massive deception by initially pointing the finger at ETA and maintaining that theory for about 48 hours after the attacks, even after there had been a number of indications that it was actually Islamic terrorists behind it.
The Popular Party, the party that was in power, that some said falsely blamed the attacks on ETA, they say that the socialists took advantage of the situation by organizing anti-war rallies just days before the elections.
Well, the entire atmosphere at the time from March 11th through the elections on the 14th was rather polarized. First, the tragedy of the attacks themselves, which were the first sort of jihadist attack on European Union soil. It was the worst terrorist tragedy in Spanish history. And then almost immediately the finger-pointing and the mudslinging began. And the atmosphere became more rarefied as the days went on. And it's true, there were massive demonstrations the day after the attacks that started to be peppered with some signs protesting the Spanish role in the Iraq War, the personal role of former Prime Minister Aznar. But by and large, the demonstrations were simply rejection of any form of terror. But by the time the elections came, there was an awful lot of mutual recrimination going on. And the feeling from the Popular Party ever since they lost was that the socialists, who had been trailing in the polls by a number of points, managed to take advantage of the rather strange circumstances to slide into an electoral victory.
And what has Prime Minister Zapatero said about accusations that, you know, when he did get into a government, there was appeasement on the part of his party because they did pull any troops out of Iraq?
Well, he's been very clear on that. And he said that there is no appeasement, not towards Islamic terror or towards the ETA. The reason that he's able to say that is that it was actually published in the Socialist Party campaign platform from the previous year, that his intention was to pull the troops out if elected. He had set a deadline later into the summer, and he had made it conditional on some sort of other authority taking over to sort of fill the gap. But the bottom line is that the socialists had promised to pull out regardless, and they did. They kept their word. At the same time, he has strengthened efforts to crack down on ETA terrorism at home.
As he says, don't tell us about terrorism. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, Spain's been fighting terrorism for 30 years. And ETA has started to raise its voice again. This is the group that was responsible for the deaths of nearly 850 people since 1968. They've set off bombs around the country in the past couple of weeks. Tell us about this recent wave of violence.
Well, it's actually been a little bit different than some previous waves because there haven't been any injuries, any victims. In fact, they've been very careful on the series of small explosive devices that they planted around Spain to call and warn security forces ahead of time so that places can be evacuated.
We understand that on December 12th, the soccer stadium was evacuated. Very big-name, high-profile soccer players also had to flee because of a threat.
Exactly. It was 2 minutes before the end of the game. Real Madrid, the biggest club in Spain, had to leave the stadium, and they had to evacuate 69,000 people in 11 minutes because of a bomb threat that was phoned in to a Basque newspaper following the sort of protocol that they do. But it turned out to be a false alarm. There was no bomb there.
We're going to talk more about ETA in a moment, but what is the sense of people there in Spain as they're hearing this sort of, as we said, the equivalent of their 9/11 commission looking into the train bombings, and there's this resurgence of violence from ETA? What's their sense?
Well, I think the overriding sentiment that's come out of the months of the commission is basically just boredom with the political mudslinging. Because, for instance, Prime Minister Zapatero's testimony was 15 hours long. If memory serves, Mr. Aznar's was 11 or 12 hours long. And basically, it's been a very polarizing situation with a he-said-she-said sort of situation.
In fact, a spokesperson for the March 11th Victims Association, sort of paralleling, again, the association in the U.S., spoke before the panel and pretty much chastised them.
And, in fact, the judge investigating the case actually filed a motion as well, pointing out that the government and authorities had been remiss in dealing with the victims of the attack. And the testimony was largely directed towards, I think, shaming the rather base political mudslinging that's characterized the commission.
And ETA, the Basque separatist group, any sense of why they'd have a resurgence now?
In the past 2 years or 2.5 years, there have been close to 500 arrests between Spanish and French authorities. And as a result, they've had successive changes of their leadership and the people that make up the operational commandos. And one phenomenon that has been observed with ETA since its founding in the late 1950s is that successive groups are increasingly more radical and more intransigent and practice more of an abstract terror for terror's sake rather than coupling it to political objectives. And so even though they've been debilitated by a lot of arrests, the people who are in charge now are more radical than their forebears, and so they're sort of giving the last dying motions, but they're still leaving their visiting cards in the form of these bombs around Spain.
Because this is all they've known. They're the next generation, correct?
Exactly. These are people who have been born. The operatives these days are generally between 19, 25 years old. So all of them were born after the arrival of democracy, after the arrival of the regional statute, which gives the Basque region more autonomy than almost any other region in Europe. And yet, precisely because of that, they have this paradox. They've become divorced from the sort of 1950s era fighting against the Franco repression idea that fueled the foundings of ETA and Basque nationalism. And it's sort of now become just an abstract sort of nihilistic terror.
Well, we're going to be, as you said, hearing more about ETA. But Keith Johnson, thanks so much for updating us.
My pleasure.
Keith Johnson, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from his home in Madrid. And when we come back, we'll learn more about ETA. What has motivated this group that's been fighting for 50 years? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about the Basque separatist group ETA waging a campaign of violence in Spain. As we just heard, ETA was first formed in the 50s in response to the oppressive policies of Spain's former dictator, Francisco Franco. After Franco died and democracy was restored in 1976, the Basque region was given some autonomy, but for a minority, that wasn't enough. They're now calling for an independent Basque state spanning parts of France and Spain. Well, joining us now on the line, Professor Joseba Zuluika from the Center for Basque Studies at the University of Nevada in Reno. He's originally from the Basque region of Spain. And Professor, many wonder, what's motivating ETA today? I'm sure you've heard the question, what's so bad about being a part of Spain?
Well, that is what we normally think when you are not inside the heat of the nationalist fervor. But if you are kind of a nationalist who feels aggrieved by being inside of Spain, there is this struggle that has produced all of these killings and all of these imprisoned and exiled and tortured people. There is a difficulty in forgetting about it. Once you have been fighting as an organization and been punished for 45 years, it's not easy to just call it off. It's not easy to the inertia of the thing we'll always have a new group of people, a new generation of young people who will keep the thing, even if it makes less and less sense. So in that regard, it's true. I mean, it doesn't make too much sense in the new European Union that you would be fighting, you would be killing for a nationalist cause. They will retort that Basque never really had an option to vote for the autonomy or for independence, so the Basque should have historically a right to say what they want to be. Mm. And once you interpret like that your history and becomes in itself a mythology and a way of acting, a never-ending thing.
It sounds as if you agree with reporter Keith Johnson, who just told us moments ago that some of this has just been ingrained in new generations who don't know any other way to live.
Yeah, that's true, but I wouldn't agree with him that the one that we have seen these last weeks is the more violent one. They are like saying, well, we are still here. We are still unresolved problem. But on the other hand, they don't dare kill. They haven't killed in 2 years. That means that they don't really know what to do, or they don't know what course to take after the 9/11 and after this new global international type of terrorism with an Islamic bend. They don't know what to do when whatever they do in those terms will be interpreted along this new terrorism, and they don't belong to this new kind of terrorism. So they don't dare kill. They don't dare be real terrorists, yet at the same time, they had to do something to say, well, we're still here. You have to somehow give us some kind of symbolic victory, at least, so that we can say all of our years of fighting were not totally in vain.
Well, what is the chance of that? What is the chance of a resolution on a political level?
Well, that is what the fight is going on. Next week, there will be this voting of this so-called Ibarreche plan, which the Spanish parties, the Partido Popular, and even the Socialists, they are opposed to it. Even the Proeta party is opposed to it. So you have these strange bedfellows between the ETA Pro Party and the Spanish being against the plan that essentially wants to renegotiate, saying, well, we want some more kind of sovereignty. I mean, they are not calling for a separate state from Spain, but they are calling for a more clear recognition of Basque nationality within Spain in a kind of federation of nationalities.
Spain does have other groups that have got their own autonomous regions within the country as well.
Yeah. These are the three regions that have historical claims to having their own nationality, the Catalans, the Basque, and the Galicians. And with Spain of post-Franco, Spain of autonomies, what happened was what is called coffee for everyone. They turned entire Spain into 17 different regions to kind of dilute these three nationalist regions. But the main lines are that about 50% of the Basque never approved of this transition to democracy with this statute of autonomy. And there are two main reasons. One was there are some major jurisdictions that have not been transferred to the Basque country that were negotiated 25 years ago with Madrid. Mm-hmm. That was number one. And secondly, even those powers being exercised by the Basque parliament and Basque government are constantly challenged by Madrid in the Madrid courts and in the European court. They want a more kind of sovereignty, so to speak, that very ambiguous word that can mean anything. For this majority moderate nationalist to be happy, it would be essentially something symbolic, and for me at the level of discourse or rhetoric by which the Basque could say, well, we have our own parliament, we have our own government, our own police, our own TV, our own university. We have our own sovereign country, but Madrid has contributed in that discourse not being allowed by constantly threatening in the courts.
Well, you said, Professor, that there was an attempt to dilute these ethnic groups within Spain. Is that happening to the Basque culture? Is it being diluted?
I think that with the new, these 25 years of Basque autonomous government, I think it has been a revival, a remarkable revival of the language, of culture, of media, etc. So that is not happening, which makes even more absurd this ETA's violence, which in fact is very crucial, detriment, very powerful against this cultural revival. Many people who otherwise would be quite happy learning the language and feeling Basque, they are revolted by it, I think. So it is a major obstacle for the cultural revival of the Basque country, I would say.
Do you think this is a problem that's going to have to be resolved within the Basque culture? Are they going to have, you know, is it going to be Basques that are going to have to stop the violence?
Certainly the Basque have to stop blaming everything to Madrid. And so now they are trying to call for a new statute, which partly would solve this division within the Basque community, those who do not want anything to do with Spain, and the rest of the population who feel like there should be some kind of an agreement within Spain.
Professor Josaiba Zulayika from the Center of Basque Studies at the University of Nevada, Reno. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, the dollar is so low that it's cheaper for Europeans to fly to New York and shop than buy at home. But how does that affect Americans? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Campaign season officially began in Iraq yesterday, ahead of January elections. Joining us from Baghdad for a check-in, Borzu Daragahi. He writes for the Boston Globe. And Borzu, the first hours of the campaign season were marked by a car bomb. How has that affected Iraqis? Is there campaigning?
It doesn't appear that there's much campaigning going on the streets of Baghdad. There don't seem to be any ads in newspapers or on television. Made the rounds of some of the political parties earlier today, and everyone said, well, maybe next week, inshallah, or God willing.
Yeah. And we understand that people are eyeing each other warily. In other words, if one candidate puts up some posters, maybe someone else will follow.
Yeah, I think that no one is really willing to be the first person to plaster their face on some wall, given the fact that one candidate who went public with the fact that he was a candidate has already been shot dead.
But, Borzu, despite the fear and, you know, the unknown, do you get a sense of excitement?
Absolutely. I know that a lot of citizens, individuals are eager. This is a novelty for them. They're eager to test the political waters and see if democracy is all that other people make it out to be.
Tomorrow is Friday prayers. Will there be campaigning in the mosques?
That's really the factor that will give a lot of the religious and Islamic parties a big advantage in this upcoming campaign, whereas other parties have to get out there on the street and organize forums at universities and public places, the Islamic parties can just call on their faithful at Friday prayers and sort of subtly tell them who they should vote for.
In a safe way.
In a very safe way, yeah. In a discreet way as well.
Borzu Daragahi, he reports for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Baghdad. Borzu, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, 150,000 Americans are deployed in the military this holiday season, away from their families. Here now's Fred Tice has the story of one military unit, a group of Massachusetts medical personnel who've been away from their homes for over a year. Their families are already looking forward to February, when the 118th Area Support Medical Battalion is slated to come home.
On winter nights, the Bridgewater Sports Complex is full of nervous parents looking for their children as one soccer game ends and another begins in the huge building. Upstairs, along a railing, Lucy Salloway is watching her daughter Lita on one of the fields below.
I didn't know she was playing.
She's 4 to go. Awesome.
His daughter's soccer games and ballet classes are one of the joys of Scott Salloway's life, but he's 6,500 miles away in the northern part of Baghdad. So Lucy does all the driving now, and when she can't, Scott's family helps. Sometimes she's late for her full-time job as a kindergarten teacher, and she's grateful when a colleague can cover her class. Scott Salloway relishes this time of year, and that makes his absence particularly hard for his family.
It's a tough thing, especially Christmas, because Scott loves Christmas. I mean, it's just like his favorite holiday, and getting up in the morning, and getting the kids up, and, you know, the presents and the whole thing. But, you know, we'll get through it, and next year will be so much better.
Scott has been gone for a year now. Since February, his unit, A Company of the 118th Area Support Medical Battalion of the Massachusetts National Guard, physician's assistants and emergency medical technicians in civilian life have been in Iraq, patching up soldiers wounded by gunshots, mortar shells, and improvised explosive devices. The family is getting by without him, but he's missing milestones in his children's lives. His youngest daughter, Sophia, started kindergarten this year.
And everything she writes is, you know, about Dad. Every picture she writes, if they do these, you got to put Dad in there somewhere. So the teacher always tells me that, you know, she's always focused on, you know, Dad not being home. But she loves him very much, and she draws him in every single picture that she does at school.
Dad was home just last month for a two-week leave. At first, his daughter Karina didn't recognize him at the airport because he'd shaved his head.
He's bald and he has a mustache and he has a tattoo.
In February, when he comes home for good, she says, her father has to shave the mustache and grow some hair. In the meantime, it was good to have him home, however briefly.
I missed 3 days of school to have to spend time with him, and the last day he was home, we all made a gingerbread house.
Well, I was just home and leave for 2 weeks, which was fun. It was good for me to get away, but I think it was harder on the family for me leaving.
Salloway is calling from a room where the troops can spend some downtime. There's the phone and a large screen TV. It's evening. Sick call is in the morning, but they're open 24 hours for emergencies. They're there to treat American soldiers, but they also take care of Iraqi civilians and enemy wounded.
They can perform some life-sustaining treatments, some orthopedic skills, minor surgery, and prep people to go here from to a hospital where they require get more definitive care, the surgeries that they need. We can do all the life-saving skills that people need, any type of acute trauma or life support.
And he says they're always mindful of the dangers.
You're in a war zone, so you're always looking at things when you're walking down the road. You're always listening. You're always mindful of what could happen and where the nearest bunker is in case something happens, where to run and seek protection.
He, too, looks forward to February when he's supposed to come home. But while he clearly misses his wife and children, it's just as clear that he finds his experiences in Iraq extremely rewarding. At home, Salloway is a physician's assistant at Sturdy Memorial Hospital in Mansfield. In Iraq, he says, he sees the casualties we hear about. He finds he's enriched by the challenges and finds satisfaction in seeing the men and women around him grow.
One time during a mass casualty, we had several injured come in, and people had always looked to me to see, take care of the patient. But when you have three or four wounded soldiers, there's only one of me to go around. And I took care of the more serious wounded one, and there's excellent hearing one of the medics say in the background, saying, "I know I can handle this. I saw Captain Salloway take care of this one time, and I know that I can do it."
This is such a difficult time for everybody.
At home in Framingham, Kathy Lazo hopes the baby won't wake up. She stays at home with the baby most of the time now and practices her profession, physical therapist, just one or two days a month. Her husband, Michael, has just been promoted to captain. He's at a combat support hospital in Mosul. Kathy Lazo is head of the medical company's family support group. In the year since the unit's been gone, the families of the battalion have spent a lot of time together, going to Six Flags, having a barbecue, taking a hayride. She says families of reservists find it necessary to reach out to one another because they live in relative isolation when compared to the families of regular soldiers.
I think the difficult thing being in the National Guard or the reserves is that we're not on an active post and we're not off an active post. You know, if they were active duty, they would be living close to post or on post, where you have that strong sense of military family. And when you're deployed with hundreds of others who are going through the same experience.
Recently, the families decided to sell those ubiquitous yellow magnets that say, "Support our troops," in order to raise money for family activities, for Christmas ornaments and menorahs for the soldiers, for shipping Christmas trees to Iraq, for clothes and toys for Iraqi children.
You'll see all of the "Support My Soldier" type magnets. So we had started it, and now it's just been inundated in the market with Christmas tree shop and whatnot. So, you know, we're kind of on the tail end of that one.
You had started a drive, but you're finding that they're all over the place already.
Cheaper. But yeah, they can get them cheaper than, you know, the extra proceeds going to our group. So
Lazo finds that even in a society that talks so much about supporting its troops, it's not always easy to get that support.
That report from Here and Now's Fred Tice. You're listening to Here and Now. National Hockey League owners this week rejected the players' offer of a 24% rollback of salaries, instead proposing a plan which included a salary cap, something the players say they won't accept. So the face-off continues. Meanwhile, hockey fans have missed seeing almost 400 regular season games, and some of the most dejected fans are not necessarily in traditional hockey cities such as Boston or Montreal. They're in Nashville, Tennessee, where a relatively new group of Sunbelt hockey fans has kept their passions alive. Reporter Kim Green caught up with them and has this report.
The Predators Pride Booster Club gets its hockey fix any way it can. Tonight, they're at a Nashville bar watching one of the so-called Predators Classics broadcast by Fox Sports South in lieu of actual games. Later this week, they'll drive 2 hours south to Alabama to watch the minor league Huntsville Havoc. Booster Club treasurer Patty Cavanaugh is a secretary who works a second job to pay for her season tickets. She says she'll return to Predators games when the lockout ends, but in the meantime, she's disappointed in the players.
They dropped off the pedestal a little bit. I think they have forgotten the fans, and they need to come work on my annual salary. And I'd like to see them handle the real world on that.
Most hockey fans here seem to feel the same way, a fact not lost on the Nashville Predators. The young team made the playoffs last spring after several years of flagging attendance. Season ticket sales surged, and it seemed the franchise's struggles were over. Team spokesman Jerry Helper says the organization has worked hard to keep fans interested since September 15th, the first day of the lockout.
We had our owner send them a letter. We then had our coach send a voice message to all of our season ticket holders. We've also done a series of season ticket holder training camps in which our coaches spent a couple hours with ticket holders, giving them a walkthrough of a day in the life of a player and a coach on a game day.
One of those season ticket holders was 49-year-old Mark Hollingsworth, who attended Game 4 of the Western Conference quarterfinals last April between the Predators and Red Wings.
Welcome to Nashville, everybody. This is the Gaylord Entertainment Center. Outside, fans celebrating, awaiting the start of this game, and inside, they are rocking.
I've never been in a building so electric in my life. That kind of energy and thrill, it's so hard when you have that as your last memory of the season and now this ridiculous lockout.
Hollingsworth is the kind of fan the Predators have worked hard to attract for more than 6 years. He's held season tickets since day one and created a fan website which serves these days as a kind of support group for disappointed fans. He's also organized one of the most notorious cheering sections in the league called Cell Block 303.
I think one of the reasons that Section 303 has become so much fun is it's a group of folks that really enjoy being together. We really watch out for each other. We have folks that are battling diseases. We visit folks like that when they're in the hospital. If somebody's been in an accident, we go visit them. We send out get well cards to folks. It's become a community.
Hollingsworth is only one of a number of Tennessee fans starving for hockey. On October 16th, around 10,000 turned out to see Nashville's minor league affiliate, the Milwaukee Admirals, when they played at the Predators' home rink, the Gaylord Entertainment Center.
Fairly impressive considering it's a minor league game in a city that's used to the NHL.
John Glennon covers the NHL for the Nashville Tennessean. He says that although hockey has made inroads in Nashville, the lockout isn't at the center of public consciousness.
Is this something that Joe Smith on the street is talking about all the time? No, probably not. But I don't necessarily see that happening in any city outside of, say, Canada or, you know, maybe Detroit or Minnesota.
In the meantime, Patty Kavanaugh says she's losing patience with Predators classics and deadlock negotiations. She offers this simple message to the league and its players.
Talk to each other. Be a man and step forward first. Because here in the United States, unfortunately, hockey is not religion like it is in Canada. And there's too much of a chance to lose hockey here in the United States. And that scares me. Talk to each other. Yeah! Woo!
Many bureaucrats play clean as country water. Many bureaucrats play wild as Mountain Dew. Many bureaucrats been playing since...
That story from reporter Kim Green. Stay with us. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the latest front in the battle between traveling New York shows and local theater, the Boston Ballet's production of The Nutcracker is finding itself squeezing into a smaller venue with a smaller stage to make way for the traveling holiday juggernaut, the Rockettes, and their Radio City Christmas Spectacular, booked by the theater the ballet long called home. What happens now? Will the Mouse Army need to be downsized? Will the tree that used to rise to the rafters at the end of the first act now be, oh, a shrub? Well, actually, the company has discovered opportunities. Here in Now's Lynn Menegon recently visited the Boston Ballet as the company was rehearsing its new production. She stumbled first upon some angels.
We're like the beginning of act two.
Well, the curtain's still down when we come on stage. Yeah.
Is it very exciting to be on stage?
Yeah, and there's fog and everything, so. Yeah.
Fog?
Yeah, it's dry. It's really cool. It's
I'm going to do it this year because of the new stage, so they're not sure.
I'm going to have to step.
No reindeer?
No cherubs either.
No cherubs?
No. I still don't get how Claire's going to get from one place to another without the reindeer.
Meanwhile, Boston Ballet artistic director Mikko Niissanen had been on his feet so much, he was wearing sneakers.
Yeah, my feet are so inflamed because I've been dancing too much myself that these are the only ones that I can comfortably exist in. The interesting thing is that the initial news of Nutcracker not having home was so huge news in this community and nationwide. No matter what we do, we can't get the message out to the same extent that people would really understand it. First thing, people say to me, oh, too bad you don't have a Nutcracker this year. And I want to say, what? We have a Nutcracker. We have a brand new Nutcracker. Nutcracker has a different address this year.
Quiet, please. Let's play from the top. Top of the act two.
What are you having to do to adapt the production? The old production was on a big stage in a big theater. Lots of people came to see it. And now you've got a logistical problem.
We're not trying to take the last year's sets, put them in here. All new sets, huge number of new costumes, all new choreography. So it's a brand new production, new take on Nutcracker. Nutcracker has to be a company development tool. Breathe, ladies. Those are fourth positions. Nutcracker is sort of the largest production of the year, produces most revenue out of any production. It is a big part of the bottom line. The choreography is very hard. It develops the dancers. Nutcracker is the ballet that people see for the first time. Angels, elegant angels wanted. When the first timers come to the see the Nutcracker, this is an introduction to the art form. Keep even distances.
Across the street from Boston Ballet's Nutcracker, the Radio City Christmas Spectacular is almost sold out.
We're going to have a crash.
While the ballet has sold only 65% of its tickets.
Good. Well, it's a two different products, you know, and that's the bottom line. I wish them well. The days when Boston was the one show town around the Christmas are not there. The rest of the North America has adjusted that a long time. Now it's a reality for Boston, and if we don't adjust to that, That would be not very smart.
Meanwhile, at the theater, Boston Ballet music director Jonathan McPhee was fretting about a different problem, a very unmusical sound.
But you hear how loud that heater is?
Yes, that's very loud.
So where we're standing right now is directly under the stage that people actually perform on. This is an older theater, and it was basically designed during the era when vaudeville shows were around. And vaudeville shows used to have maybe 18, 20 people in the orchestra. The challenge is to take a full orchestra now and put it in the space that a vaudeville orchestra would have occupied. And this is where the percussion and the brass are going to be.
It's a totally separate room from the orchestra pit.
Right. We have two orchestra pits, basically. This is the virtual pit, and that's the real pit. Basically, just to give you an idea, it's going to be run like a big recording session. So you see lots of electronics down here and headsets, and musicians are on headsets very much like they would be for a commercial recording session.
So that heats the whole theater, and you've got to get rid of it.
No, it heats the under stage area. You'd be able to hear that all the way through the show.
You could hear that all the way through the show. Oh, because you're putting everything on microphone.
Yes. And that's why going at this from the standpoint of a recording session is the only thing that made any sense. Because frequently in recording sessions, even for the movies, you have percussion isolated in a separate room so they can control the gain and the peaks in sound. And we're basically doing exactly the same thing. It's just normally there's a little more exchange between the sections in a session. Like you wouldn't have a brick wall here. You'd have a clear plexiglass.
So there's a brick wall separating. Let's go into the other area here. There's a brick wall and a set of stairs separating this trap space where all the percussion is from the rest of the orchestra.
The orchestra and me. And you see, I'll be on this little TV screen here.
Very clever.
So you have two of these just in case one goes out.
Oh, my. Well, we're now trying to climb over all of these chairs and microphone cables. And I think this little space is the size of someone's, I don't know, garage. But you've got how many people going to show up in this little space?
Oh, let's see here. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, about 29 people.
It's like the clowns in the Volkswagen kind of thing.
Well, we've planned very carefully, though, so that we've staggered the string chairs so that their bows should go between the group next to them.
Oh, so that's right. They don't poke each other in the ear
that's
or hit
right.
themselves in the head or something.
Or damage their bow by hitting the wall or something like that. So we've actually, this is not our normal, it's not our normal setup at all.
What about the children's choir? Boston Ballet was famous for being, I think, the only...
Only one in the world. Only ballet company in the world that had every single performance covered by a live chorus. And the live chorus was always the girls who danced in Chinese tea, bonbons, now called attendants, and angels. They're not here this year.
Oh, no.
It was because I just couldn't... There was physically no place to put them.
And how, tell me how are you going to get across here to get to say hello to the audience?
Well, there won't be any grand entrance like there is normally. I'll just be coming out here and taking my place so that everybody can get themselves situated.
Carefully climbing over the first violins.
Yeah.
All right, good luck.
Thank you very much.
I should say break a leg.
Break a leg.
Here now is Lynn Menegon, produced our visit to the Boston Ballet. And we're happy to note the company is getting good reviews. And the little angels in the Nutcracker do get to dance in fog. The Boston Ballet moves back to a bigger theater for the Nutcracker next year. For information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Thanks for help today from NPR's Only a Game. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.